and welcome to Take No Script. This is Riley.
I am Jane.
And this past couple of weeks, we watched Sharp Objects. It's the It's the minimum series about a crime reporter named Camille Parker. Preaker. It's about the crime reporter Camille Preaker, who returns to her hometown to solve the murder of two young girls. However, she is forced to face and deal with her family and her past. Okay, so today we're going to talk about the show, obviously.
Obviously.
Now we just love hearing ourselves talk in British accents. What did you think of the show, darling?
I loved it.
You loved it. What did you love about it?
I loved it. It was just... I don't know. what are words for cool?
Did you cream your pants a bit?
You know, I might have a couple times. It was 3 a.m. and I was watching it and I was expecting there to be a jump scare through the dollhouse. And there wasn't, but...
I'm so sorry.
It was brill. It was a brill. I was so chuffed about it.
What the fuck did you just say? I don't know this slang. What is this?
It's because you've only wiped your ass in London. You haven't been to real Britain.
No, not proper.
Out here,
not proper Britain.
In the Cockneys.
Down with the Cockneys. Gonna be unhinged. So, what did you like about it exactly?
I liked that Camille was also unhinged. I could see a lot of us in her.
Yes.
It's hard to think and make my mouth do a British accent. I think I'm pulling a little bit from Harry Potter.
I see it. Yeah. I like it.
I'm actually an extra in the movies.
Yeah. I'm just like amazed by your British accent. So you're so good at it.
Oh, thank you, darling. Oh, you warm my crumpets.
Would you like to butter my crumpets for me? I like lots of butter on my crumpets, thank you. So you liked Camille because she was unhinged, just like us.
She was unhinged. I sure did.
With the hair flip.
I don't know what that was. Pardon me. I must have had something caught in my throat.
It's all those crumpets. So what was your favourite unhinged moment of Camille's?
I don't know. She was unhinged the whole time.
Yeah, so you liked it all.
I liked it all. I liked it all. I liked Adora's character as well.
I did too.
Did you?
I did. She's very good at being a villain.
She's so good. I looked at the actress and I saw that she has pictures where she's smiling and she looks like a nice person, and I was like,
and she's kind of stunning.
She really is. She's so stunning, and I thought, there's no way this person isn't a psychopath.
No, just there's no way. No way. I mean, her fashion sense. There's no way. Her kitchen.
There really is something so uncanny about people that are too perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, they always have their makeup done, their hair's always up, their clothes are always ironed and pressed and all that. And it's so unnerving.
Yeah. Yeah, what is
that? Right? Neuroticism, maybe?
Yeah, why is it unnerving for other people?
It's like, there's nothing that makes you human.
It's like an uncanny valley.
Yeah, like, if you have everything is perfect, everything's the way it's supposed to be, then where are you? Because if there's not any part of you, then you're just like a cardboard cutout of a person. But you're also moving and interacting with me, and that's really creepy.
Well, the creepy part is, what are you hiding?
Yes! What are you hiding? Especially with... I hate old houses. I had to break character there. I hate old houses. I hate Victorian houses. I hate Louisiana houses. All the old houses, they can go fuck themselves.
Why?
They're so creepy. They creak. And they are beautiful during the day, but just think about at night, everything creaks and groans, and you can't tell if somebody's in your house or if it's just a draft. And
my body creaks and groans. It's quite creepy. And it also only happens at night.
Darling, have you ever thought about exorcism?
No, I'm too busy living my life. I'm too busy being fabulous during the day to ever consider exorcism at night.
My demons, their schedules are all packed, I'm sorry. You'll have to come back another time.
Maybe like a 2027 exorcism, but I don't have time for it now.
Wait, I want to hear what your favourite parts of it were.
I have lots of favourite parts. I love the really uncomfortable parts. Like, the small moments that Camille has with Amma when they're roller skating and you're not sure what's happening and how everyone's feeling. And I like all those little uncomfortable moments that they all have together. I like the moments where you can see Camille almost accepting herself and her dark parts and just leaning into it instead of trying to put on a show or trying so hard to be not like everyone else that it's still putting on a show.
The small moments you mentioned, I really felt that between Adora and Camille. When you see Adora and she has this quiet malice intermingled with love and some sort of twisted affection, and she looks at Camille and you can see Camille, this sort of vulnerability in her eyes, that she still wants this love. She recognizes that it's twisted and she still wants it, and both actresses, they just played it so quietly, whispering, and it made it so good.
Yes, they both have a quiet yearning for one another.
Quiet yearning, that's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, like Camille, there's that scene where Camille's just watching her mom caring for Amma, and there's this want there, but also this resentment, and also this fear. Like, all at once. Yeah, they all did such a great job at encompassing it. Even Amma is, like, scary good. She's terrifying. Really is. So, you liked it. Yay.
I really liked it. And it was nice that I didn't remember the book, actually, because then it was kind of a whole new experience that I was having.
Yeah, and there are quite a few differences in the book compared to the show. Have you read a lot of Gillian Flynn?
I love Gillian Flynn.
Yeah.
I read Gone Girl, and I've read that a couple of times. And then I read the three books that she's put out so far. I read all of them. And I don't remember Dark Places as much. I don't know if the little snippets that I have of them are getting mixed up with Sharp Objects, because I've read them all in the same summer. But I love Gillian Flynn. If I could write like her one day.
I know, I'm always waiting for her to put out new stuff.
Yes, I would have thought that she would have by now. I saw that she's working as a publisher or something for the time being.
You know, she actually wrote something short.
The Grown Up?
Oh, is that it?
The psychic who's hired to help a woman who fears her house is haunted and her stepson's possessed.
I didn't love it. But I was so desperate to read it because I just wanted more Gillian Flynn. And actually, it's funny that her top selling book, I think, was Gone Girl and became the most popular. Mm-hmm. But it's actually my least favorite of those three.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What knocked it down?
The believability. I had a really hard time believing it. And I didn't understand the motive for the characters, and because of that, it just didn't seem very believable to me, and I had a hard time empathizing with. It's been a while. Unlike the other two books, I've only read it once, and I watched the movie once, and I remember being disappointed as I develop the smoker's voice. I remember being disappointed with, not disappointed, that's just not really scratching the itch that I wanted it to scratch after reading Sharp Objects and Dark Places, because I think they're very different from Gone Girl. I do think that Gone Girl is more palatable for most people.
Palatable's a good word for it. I actually read Gone Girl first, and I think I had the benefit of that, because once I read Sharp Objects and Dark Places, I remember trying to find more dark psychological thriller. And after that, all I'd been able to find was A Woman in the Window and Girl on the Train, stuff like those. And it didn't really scratch the same itch.
No, they're really not the same. And then there's the whole just putting woman in all of the titles. I've read all of the women books. And none of them are quite as twisted. And I think it's because Gillian must just be fucking twisted in so many brilliant ways that she's able to come up with this.
I wonder what her mind looks like, you know, when she walks by the same grocery stores or libraries or anything. I wonder what she sees when she's looking at people or windows or anything at all. She probably sees some fucked up shit.
It's not very good. No. It can't be good. It can't be good, and I love it. And I want her to put all of it into a book.
Yes, absolutely.
She really taps into, I know we always talk about, you know, we have our little twisted brains, and I feel like she does such a great job of putting a lot of my feelings and a lot of my ugly thoughts into words, and makes it in a very digestible way.
I often don't see myself as someone that's very sympathetic, maybe, to the average person. Not in that they couldn't sympathize with me, but that a short tidbit story of my life wouldn't really resonate in quite the same way that other stories do, because it's just not the type of story we're used to resonating with. And so when I watched this, I was so surprised by how much I saw of myself in the character, but it also felt like it had a wide appeal.
Yeah.
So I'm not used to that overlap.
I like the way that you say that, the overlap, because it's not like one thing becomes another, but it is a bit of an overlap. And I think that, I don't know, I think her work is very comforting for me.
Mm.
And it's also, the fact that other people that maybe would generally not resonate with parts of me can see that and feel something, I think is really, it's just impressive. It's impressive that she can do that. Pick a topic. Pick a topic. Journalism. Do you have many thoughts about journalism?
I think journalists are often protagonists of stories, especially thriller stories, because there's that suspension of disbelief as to why they're in any given strange, odd situation. And I thought about, you know, something that's often discussed in journalism is the line between exploitation of a subject matter and when is it important to inform an audience.
Mm-hmm. I have a hard time thinking that most things like that are not some version of exploitation. at its core, it's like, is it doing more good than harm? And I think if doing journalism in a way that produces more good than harm, then that's probably decent journalism.
Where do you think the line is drawn? Because I could see for, you know, a small town that these sort of articles coming out while there's so much unrest would contribute to the unease, the distrust, the possibility of violent altercations. But at the same time, without any of that information, what would the public really know? And I feel like there is a point at which the exploitation does not have a benefit to others. And I know this is talked about in the true crime community, right? Commodifying these horrific acts against people for clicks and, you know, ad revenue and internet clout. And I don't think I have myself a very good opinion on it yet, because only now is really, you know, a couple years into the true crime community really getting big, and I listen to a lot of true crime content, is that discussion really coming up, as there are so many creators who are trying to get in on that sphere.
I remember when the Dahmer show came out on Netflix. Did you watch that?
I didn't watch the Dahmer show because I had followed, I read a whole bunch about the cases like a little bit earlier, but it's on my to watch list.
I mean, it's scary good acting.
Is it really? Oh goodness. Those sorts of documentaries and shows, I haven't watched it, but I read a bunch of critical reviews of it, and the consensus was that it was quite respectful to the subject matter.
It was.
It was respectful towards the victims. It almost, it keeps their stories, and I think the lessons around tactics that serial killers use, right? It provides information towards other people who might have otherwise become victim to those sorts of things.
And I do think it was respectful the way they, I think they painted out all victims to be people and not victims. And I think that's, I think it's easy for me to say because I'm not involved in any way, but I never knew about any of the victims. I didn't know anything about them until watching this. And it helped me see them as real people with real lives who were affected by something tragic and not just this famous serial killer. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But also at the end of the day, that sounds so sweet and cute, but I just wanted to watch a show that made me feel good.
I mean, at the end of the day, I think a lot of people will try to argue these philosophical reasons for why or why not they watched it, but the majority of people are going to have watched it because it was good television.
It was good television.
Good telly. It was good telly. Telly.
And people are curious. I think that's where a lot of true crime comes from and why it's so popular.
See, here's the thing, is that if I was living in a town where people were dying, being murdered viciously, I would want to be informed of this. Similarly, I think that respectful true crime content informs people how you can protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stop for random strangers in the night, no matter how pathetic they look. No babies, no children. You pull over, you lock your car doors, you call 911 or whatever it is in London. And you don't get out of the...
999.
Oh, 999.
I don't know. Now I want to know. It's 999. Look at me. Proves that I've been waiting my house in London for all this time.
But like, you don't engage, you have what is it, your like passwords, your like notes for your loved ones so that they can find information about you should you ever go missing, right? Like all of these things that you can put in line to protect yourself, even just having apps that your friends can track you on, right? That's something that, at least for me, I never thought about any of these things before I was into true crime. I just kind of felt that random murders were things that happened to other people.
Yeah.
Not that I wasn't afraid when I went out, but I think that I didn't have anywhere for that fear to go that was tangible, and like could tangibly protect me.
Right.
Or help me at all.
And maybe that's why women are so into true crime. Maybe true crime content is just PSAs for women.
I mean, honestly, I don't think that's wrong at all. There are so many things that I've learned and so many boundaries that I've set down for what I will and won't do for strangers that came directly from true crime.
Yeah.
Because I used to be somebody, I think I told you about this, when I lived in a different city, but I was driving around at like 3 a.m. and I had one of those GPSs that you attach to your car. I didn't have my actual phone with me. And the GPS was dying, so I pulled over into this random gas station parking lot, like an hour away from where I lived, in the middle of nowhere. And I hear a knocking on my door, on the window, and I scream, and I look over, and it's this little old Asian lady in a hospital gown.
Nope. Mm-mm.
with tattered hair, and you know, she's missing some teeth, and she keeps knocking, and so I roll the window down, and I ask her, what do you want? And she says that she's just been discharged from the nearby hospital. I'm like, where's the hospital? I don't see it. She's just been discharged. She has no way of getting home, no wallet, no identification, no keys, and she asks if I can drive her home.
No.
And I didn't know how to say no, and all the alarm bells were going off in my head. Obviously, I'm still alive, so it turned out fine, but all the alarm bells are going off in my head, you know, but I let her into my car, and I tell her to direct me to where her apartment is, and so I start driving, and at one point, you know, the whole time, she's turned sideways, staring at me, just straight on staring at me, and I'm trying to make I know at one point she moves her arm, and in my head I just saw the vision of her taking out some scissors and just like stabbing me in the face, but it was fine. I screamed, and then she jumped, and then I jumped, and then she put her arm back down. I don't think there was anything in it to begin with, but we drove for about 20 very strained, awkward minutes, and we get to this tiny little run-down apartment complex in the middle of a bunch of other small rundown apartment complexes. And I drop off and I ask her, you know, do you need anything else? Because I'm stupid and I want to die here. I don't know where I am either at all. And I have no way of contacting anybody if I go missing. So there's no way of contacting me. There's no way of tracing me. Nothing at all. And she says nope, and then she totters off her way and disappears into the night. I don't even think she went up into the apartment complex that she said she lived at. And I just peel away from the parking lot, and my heart is racing, and I'm sweating, and I just think to myself, that was the stupidest fucking thing ever done. But that's the sort of person that I was, that I didn't know how to say no, because she was so insistent that she was, you know, suffering and had no other options. And so I just did it, and she could have just killed me.
Maybe she was staring at you because she'd never seen an Asian that looked quite like you. She's like, well, that she can't be Asian. She can't be Asian.
I feel like maybe she asked me about it, but honestly, I don't even remember. I think she told me her name. I can't remember that either. I think I just blocked out the whole traumatic memory, and I said, fuck it. I'm just, lesson learned. I'm never revisiting that again.
I'm going to retain none of these details, so when the cops are asking me, I'll have no memory of any of this. Well, I'm glad that you know better now. Hopefully.
Better. And I definitely have no problem saying no now. Like, if somebody comes up to my car window now, even in broad daylight, I wave them off and ignore them. Like, I don't care what you want. If I'm alone in the car, just me, No.
Just start knocking on the window back at them. Can you put it down, please? I've got something to tell you. Can you please put the window down?
Wait, that's so good. I'm going to take that. I'm going to actually use that.
For all the times that people are coming up to the window just tapping on it.
Have you ever had experiences like that?
Where someone's just tapping on my window?
Well, more where you find yourself in situations where you could have been murdered.
Oh, I mean, yes. Yes, and usually...
Of course!
Yeah, of course. I am a woman. And it's always been... It always, I don't know, at least the ones that stand out to me have been with men. And...
Of course.
Of course. Once I was walking back home, not too far from here, I was walking back home. It was kind of late at night, and this man stopped. He pulled over and asked if I wanted a ride to wherever I was going, and I said, no, that's fine, I will walk, thank you. And he proceeds to follow me slowly in his car.
Oh my God.
And he's like, no, really, looks like you could use a ride, like I can just take you, it's fine. And I was like, no, really, like, please leave me alone.
So disgusting.
And after that, he just kept slowly following me. It's a busy road too. I'm not sure why he thought, you know, just completely, like, no one was going to see this, or I don't know. And I just keep walking. He keeps trying to yell things at me from his car, and I just continue to walk. And I was terrified the whole time, because there's just this man that knows that I'm walking alone by myself, about to make a turn onto a quieter street, which he did not turn on, but which is good, but still, it's terrifying. And, you know, I've had instances of even men that I know, and no is a loose word, you know, that your acquaintances with, who offer to give you a ride back home. This is a real story. He offers to give me a ride back home. And another person that we work with, another man that we work with, goes out of his way to drop the other guy off first, and then drop me off when it would have made much more sense to drop me off first, and then doesn't let me out of the car, locks the door, and I'm trying to get out of the car, and he will not let me out of the car.
Oh my God.
And keeps trying to make out with me as something, or eat my face off, and I am just pulling... It couldn't be more obvious that I want nothing to do with this, and I'm trying to get out of the car, and he will not let me... He keeps locking it when I... He keeps locking it as I unlock it, and will not let me out of the fucking car. And he thought it was silly. He's, like, laughing, and... Eventually I got out, and I didn't do anything about it, because on the scale of things that happen, it's really not that bad compared to other things that happen.
Did you have to keep working with him?
Yes, I think so. I blacked out a whole chunk of my memory. I believe he still worked there for a while. Yeah, he must have. Anyway, I do not like people.
I do not like them. That's so fucked up.
It's fucked up.
I have definitely been in situations where men have followed me, obviously catcalled.
Yeah.
But I've never been locked in a car with one, having to literally beat them back. I don't even know. I'm so scared that if that ever does happen, I'm going to freeze, because my trauma response is like, fawn, freeze, and then flee,
mm-hmm.
and then fight the very, very end. And so I'm so scared that freeze is going to be the one that happens.
That's not useful trauma response.
No, it's not a useful trauma response at all.
You should really work on that.
Sometimes, I wonder if my... I think evolution is such bullshit. Not that it's fake, mm-hmm. but like bullshit insofar as we get dealt such a shitty hand of cards that our ancestors, they really only had to survive long enough to make babies.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, it's totally fine. Quality of life is shit. You die early. Your brain doesn't function. What the fuck ever. As long as you can pop out a couple babies.
Yeah,
and so now I think, well, of course my brain's fucked. I didn't need to have a fight response or a flee response. If I just froze, then it's totally fine.
All right, let's pick a new topic.
So there are two topics that I really wanted to talk about outside of the questions about the plots. I really wanted to talk about female rage.
Yes.
And at least touch on the family dynamics. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there to mine, but I really, really wanted to hear your thoughts on the female rage parts. Yeah.
I have lots of female rage. For those who are listening, if you're listening, you're probably not listening by this point, because why would you be? You're probably a decent person. June and I spent, you know, more time talking about our female rage prior to recording than we do actually recording.
Very many hours.
Yes. So let's jump back in. Female rage.
Plenty to go around.
Control is probably the biggest way that I exhibit my rage. And I think for all my life it's been like that, whether it's been through the very appropriate self-harm and that being a way of control, or being very particular about the setting around me, or just being very particular about everything, not to an unhealthy degree, but being able to keep everything else around me in order does help me feel okay. And okay just meaning that I get to deal with the stresses of life and not complaining about being a woman, but there is a lot that comes with being a woman. And control makes my life easier, and I'm not tricking myself into thinking that I realistically have control over anything, but I like putting an effort into things that I think I can have an effect on, as opposed to everything else that is very chaotic.
Mm-hmm. I thought, so I agree with you. I think for me, control is really, it's a very strong one. So obviously in the self-harming, and a little bit of a side note, but I really liked the depiction of the self-harm scars in this, because typically when there's a character that's referenced to have self-harm, they won't usually have lasting visible scars, right? Which, you know, I have scars on my arms. And so the reality for me is that it wasn't just, you know, some shot with like little pinpoints of blood in the moment, right. But it's something that lasts, especially when they're deep enough to form those, you know, hypertrophic scars, mm-hmm. with the white and the sheen. So self-harm was definitely a big one for me, and it was often, I think we had different motivations for self-harming. Mine was often when my emotions were so super high and I couldn't control them. So in the miniseries, we see Camille, she's not really externally breaking down, but you can kind of tell that mentally she's imploding a little bit, right. And that's when she starts doing it. And that was very much, you know, my way of doing things, because growing up, I couldn't externalize anything. You know, I couldn't be upset, I couldn't say anything. And I really taught myself to not feel things for a while, you know, when you're like an angsty teenager. And so that was my only way of really getting all of that rage out of me. And since then, it's changed a bit, but I still find that, yeah, I'm very particular about certain things, like where clothes are, even the way they're hung, the way towels are folded, the way things are cleaned. I just want to, for those things to be done a certain way, and I recognize that objectively, attaining that does not change any reality, but it makes me feel like I can be in a place where the things that are hard to tackle are, maybe better to say, the things that are tackleable have been tackled, and that gives me the confidence that I need to try to even think about these things that are just not controllable at all. You know, you just can't control so many things about life. And I saw that a lot in Adora, right? The way she treats the girls, and she's so controlling. And I saw my mother in that as well. You know, she was also very controlling, a very different way than my father was. And I think that that's really interesting because it's something that I think you see a lot more in women and in female characters than you do in both real life men and male characters, right? That specific way of controlling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that your mom was also like that, because so is my mom in a very, it's very particular about how things had to be in the house, how we had to dress, how, you know, very, very over the top ways of things needing to be cleaned. And, you know, thinking back, I can definitely have empathy for her in that I understand that she was also feeling completely nuts and just trying to get some control, you know, and I think, like, I get that, you know, and it's weird saying it because it drove me just off the wall, you know, but I find myself being like her in a lot of ways when it comes to that, and trying to, you know, especially my space around me, if I can at least, you know, because there's safety in that too, and having a little bit of control, and if I can just feel safe where I am and things can be the way I want them, then to me that's like a good foundation.
Did your mum ever, well, I think you've talked about, she did use social cruelty against you, right? Mm-hmm. Like inviting your friends over. I think that's also a really interesting and often female specific
way of, yes,
channeling rage.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't know what all of that is about, right? Like me also being female and what she projected onto me, and then how that translates into what she is, what she isn't, what she wanted to be, what she couldn't be, what her mother was, you know, all these things. Not excusing it, because I think it was horrible, but I don't know, I guess even just talking about it now, like, I feel like I understand parts of it, you know, because not everyone can deal all that well. I think it's pretty tough dealing.
For sure.
It takes a lot of energy. Yeah, did your mom do that?
It was a little bit different because my mom did not interact with my friends. My friends never came over to our apartment or anything like that. So it was very much that she, like, maligned everyone else. Like, she was convinced that it was me and her and our family against the world, you know. So she talked about how, you know, my 8-year-old classmate friend, best friend, she's a bad influence on me, and, you know, her parents are gossiping with all the other parents and they're spreading nasty rumors about us because they're jealous of us, and, you know, the teachers are all in cahoots, and, like, all of these super paranoid sort of ideas about what the social structures were like that at the time were very confusing. And now, looking back on it, I recognize that it was all rooted in her fear and in her not having any sort of control or access to that environment, right? So to build it up to the biggest threat it could be was her way of ensuring that she had accounted for everything, right? But it was really, I think I still struggle with this now, that I don't, immediately in my head, there's those thoughts of, like, is this person going to be talking about me, or what's this person's agenda? And it doesn't really bother me, because at the end of the day, I don't really give a fuck, like, you know, you talking about me, like, what the fuck's that going to do to me, you know, I don't. But for my mom, it was a really huge thing. And so for a while I thought that it should make a huge impact on me, and I didn't even really understand why, what the repercussions were. I just knew that there must be, because she would literally hold me, you know, by my shoulders and, like, you know, bring me super close to her face and tell me that, like, whatever, my second grade teacher, she hated me and she was out to get, like, she was out to sabotage my college applications, like, 12 years from now. And all of these, you know, all of these things that she built up in her head about, you know, what other women specifically were like, because she did not like other women. You know, I think it's very similar to in the show where it's not like the men are innocent, right? But the women only target each other, and she only ever targeted other women.
Yeah.
I remember coming home in elementary school, and I mentioned that one of my classmates' mums was really pretty, and the next time my mum went to a parent-teacher night or something like that, and for years after that, I heard about how, like, that woman wasn't that pretty, and how she looks like a man, and, like, she's wearing so much makeup, and all those sorts of things that you hear. And it was never levied towards, like, my dad, for example, who was, like, an objectively shitty person. It wasn't that he wore too much makeup or he dressed in the wrong clothes. It was that he was a morally bankrupt person. And I think that, you know, I had a phase for a little bit where I was very not like other girls, and there was a lot of that internalized misogyny towards myself and towards other women as well. And that was something that took a long time to unlearn, and even longer to kind of redirect that rage where it belonged, right? Which is not to say it only belongs on men, because there are women who are absolutely shitty as well. Which I like that this movie has, the women are villains, right? Because part of it is that you're underestimating what women are capable of. You've boxed female rage into what it's supposed to look like. And it's an inferior, weaker sort of rage. And, like, the women in the show that it's not that, right? It might be different, but it's definitely not inferior. But I definitely had to learn how to redirect that and think about, you know, why are there these judgmental thoughts towards some random person because of what? Because she took a little extra time with her hair? Like, what's the harm in that, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't know where the where the threat comes from. Yeah, my mom would do the same thing. She always, anytime I started to like make a friend at school, she would try to turn me against them. And make it seem like, oh, you can't trust that person, you can't trust anyone, don't tell them things, they're not really a friend, so-and-so is using you, as if there was anything to gain from being friends with me.
A seven-year-old, like a eight-year-old.
Yeah, like, what? No. if anything, I was such a loser that if anyone was friends with me, they'd have a lot to lose, you know, being seen around me. You know, even the way that she talked about her own, you know, quote-unquote friends, she would be like, oh, well, I don't trust anyone, and just talking shit about her own friends, you know?
Yeah, she says, or at some point to Camille, you'll be giving them the gift they want most, which is the opportunity to talk about me behind my back. And it's almost as if there's not even the consideration that any of her friends would feel concerned for her, miss her, feel fondly for her. You know, there's no even entertaining that kind of idea. And you see that passed down, right? In all the generations, none of the female friendships are true ones. They're not supportive. They're all, you know, waiting for the moment to like aim for the jugular of the other, you know. And meanwhile, I mean, who are the men in the town, right? We've got they're all sort of like emasculated, right? I mean, the dad, we haven't talked about, you know, your thoughts on whether he's complicit or how much he knows, but he does nothing. I mean, even when it's obvious that Adora is being aggressive or being unfair, he just, no, passivity is what he chooses. And the police officer, he just wants to be able to blame her on the others, you know, the Mexican truck drivers, the immigrants. He wants to be able to other somebody and then blame it on them. Who else? Like the barber who does nothing, the police detective Richard, who, I mean, ultimately, like, even when he knows that John didn't do it, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't really fight.
Right.
And then John, even John, right? I like John. And John also kind of, he gave up, right? I don't think the women, they never really gave up the way that the men did, at least in this show.
Yeah, I mean, all the men were so passive.
They were so passive.
I mean, even the way that John behaved after his sister's murder. And the way that he just let everything happen around him. It's like, I understand you're dealing with something, but... I mean, he was just so passive the whole time. And, you know, even the way he was with his girlfriend.
Yeah, when he says, Tess Camille, I think... Do you know when you know you've let something go on for too long, but you just don't have the energy to end it?
Mm-hmm.
With all the fights and everything. And I just thought, it doesn't have to be a difficult thing. You say you're done, you leave.
Right.
What's hard about it? You know, what about that is harder than the emotional toll of living that unwanted life every single day?
Yeah, gosh, to play devil's advocate a bit.
I love it.
I wonder if, you know, we always talk about our texting anxiety and people not understanding it, and it seems like such a simple thing to do for many people. You've got a message, you have a reply in your head, just type the thing out and hit send, and then it goes on its way, and then you get to reply back, and then you do the same thing. It's very easy. You know, I wonder if for a lot of men, they have a lot of anxiety about that, and there's just this thing, and then they just feel very misunderstood, which makes it harder to do the thing, because you're like, well, I'm not going to do it right, I'm not going to do it the way that these people expect me to do it, why even try to do the thing?
For sure, and I definitely agree with you. I think a lot of men are very avoidant of conflict that's not, you know, worked out with your fists. And I think that probably stems from they aren't comfortable with what they are feeling. They aren't comfortable with who they are, because the socially prescripted idea of a man is so harshly beat into them from such an early age. And I empathize. And also I feel that this isn't particular to John. In the case of this town, for example, I think society as a whole, there's so much that's patriarchal. So you have these men who are at the top of the food chain, but are unable to handle these sorts of, any sort of emotional difficulty. And that just seems like it should be, that should be expected of somebody who's in a leadership position, who has power over others, right? And obviously not for John, because he's an 18-year-old kid who definitely was not played by an 18-year-old right. actor. No. Yeah. I literally thought he was 25 yeah. or something like
he's
that.
He's probably 25.
But like the police officer, right? And it's like you're supposed to protect people, but all you want to do is smoke your cigarettes and say hi and do your rounds about the town and, you know, catch up on the gossip and go to Adora's house and lay next to her and, you know, all these sorts of things. And it's just so hard to really, it's so hard to put that empathy first when these people's actions like harm like so many others, like below them, you know?
Yeah. For whatever reason, like we were saying before we even started recording, the amount of pressure that there is on women and the amount of mental gymnastics that we need to do on a daily, on a minute-by-minute basis, and just all the work that we put into everything, I feel like there's still a part of, like a twisted part of that, where we want to make sure that we're doing it better than other women.
I think so. I absolutely do.
And like your womanhood is somehow threatened by someone else possibly being able to do all of that better and have a nice hairdo and put the makeup on.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. It's just so... you know, it's funny, like, you know, everyone's like, oh, we're living in a man's world, but it's like women are so pitted against each other and kind of don't focus on the men at all.
I was about to say that I think that in some regards, it's like in Sharp Objects, right? The men are sort of like the livestock. They're just herded in, right? And they kind of frenzy among themselves But the women are the ones who are making the real decisions, and they're the ones who move all the chess pieces. And I think that that's also, you know, misogyny is that double-edged sword. It doesn't benefit men or women, right? And so for men, right, you have this, it's almost like two women competing against each other. It's like, oh, well, I can cook just as good as you. I keep house just as good as you. And, you know, I work out every day and I have a hairdo and my face is done. And I think that we're socialized to believe that by virtue of her, like, looking better and providing the same things, our partner will leave us for that.
Right.
Right. Just by virtue of even just her appearance. And I think that's so demeaning to men, right? It's like you take away their agency, their individuality, their preferences, and you reduce them to people who are just led around by their dicks. Right. Right, and then, but you set that expectation, and then they fill that expectation, and it's just this horrible circle where there's no incentive to break it at all.
Yeah, I mean, right, because we really just want to continue to impress men constantly.
Exactly.
By putting down other women.
There's so much incentive to continue it. This is kind of a tangent, but related, like an offshoot. The party scene, right, where the two friends kiss each other to pass the X, and then Arma kisses Camille, and it's, I don't know, have you had friends who talked about, like, performative lesbianism?
Yes.
Sort of a thing? Mm-hmm. And I find that so, like, not lesbianism itself, not being women with other women, but I find the performative part of it so sickening, the fetishization,
right,
and the expectation that young women should play into that,
right,
to be cool, mm-hmm, to be sexy or desired. And every person, you know, boy or girl, they're growing up, they want to feel, you know, desired by the, like, they want to feel like they're attractive, they want to feel like, oh, like that cute boy, he thinks I'm cute too, or whatever. And for girls, that means making out with your friend, even if you're completely straight,
mm-hmm,
right, making out with them so, like, solely for, like, men to gaze at you and get,
right,
off on it, not at all for your pleasure, your experimentation, or your, like, personhood. You're just a fleshlight who is surrounded by a person, like, surrounded with a person shaped like sentient flesh blob that can do sexy things with another one. And I always find that so, whenever I see it in any show, whether it's supposed to be commentary or not, it always feels to me so disgusting, because you don't see the guys kiss each other.
No,
right?
And I've definitely played into that growing up. Like, I know in college especially, I played into that, and never did, mm-hmm, it feel good, and I would question myself afterwards, like, what, why did you do that, what did you get out of that? Oftentimes the way that I do anything is sometimes dictated by men and how it will be perceived.
Yes,
by men.
Absolutely.
Or how it will be perceived by men through the eyes of other women, you know, because,
mm-hmm,
even that is it, whether it's even, you know, a partner's mother, you know, and how she might view and how that affects the way that he views you, you know.
So we're expected to humanize ourselves in ways that men are not expected to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that some women who are faced with this, they choose to feel like, you know, I don't know if you ever felt, or if your friends ever felt, like, because I've heard friends talk like, oh, like the female body is just objectively more beautiful, like, I'm straight, but of course I want to, like, grind up on my friend, right? It's just female bodies are so beautiful. It's like this covert sort of objectification that's disguised as a good thing.
Right.
And it's like, it's still unequal, you know, why can't men's bodies be beautiful? Why can't men's bodies be used as sexual objects in the way that women's bodies are used? It's very, like, trying to make it gendered, I think, only ever makes it worse. Even if you're trying to use something like women are beautiful, you know, people are beautiful, it makes it worse no matter how you try to spin it. I'm actually curious about your thoughts on, like, the characters, like, Alma's motivations, the dad, all that, like, if you think that Camille would have turned Alma in, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so I feel like if we want to talk about Alma's motivation, I think her mom expects a lot from her, and she did use a lot of that social cruelty against her when it came to other girls in her school or her supposed friends. I don't think that's the whole picture, but I do think it is where a lot of the emotion comes from. I think in a sense she's kind of, as much as she is, you know, especially in the book she's also depicted this way, but she's very cute, you know, she's like sexy and very like sexual and flirty, and she's popular, and I think even though she does a pretty good job of latching on to all those like ideals that a woman can be even as a teenager, she tries very hard to then distance herself from women, even though she wants to be like an epitome of one. She also is like, well, I'm not like you and I'm different, and sort of uses women to her advantage while also pushing them away. And she obviously has a lot of trauma when it comes to her relationship with her mom, and probably with her dad too, you know. And he's there kind of in his silence, whether he agrees or not, he is being agreeable in watching Adora treat her like a doll, almost like this cute little doll, and being okay with it by not saying anything. It's still being okay with it. And I think, you know, even at the end where she ends up killing her, I know this in the book necessarily, but in the show, she ends up killing her other new friend. I think it's just because at that point, she's already stopped valuing other women. And it's just so tarnished at that point. I mean, I don't think she has really much value in herself either. And getting control over it, right? Like, this is something she can control, and yeah, she can have control in these ways and express herself and all of her anger in these ways towards the people that she thinks are responsible for all of her rage.
I think it's, yeah, you said, I liked the part that you said about her wanting to be the epitome of a woman and also not, and also distancing herself from women. It's almost like if she can be perfect enough of a woman, she can, like, catapult herself out of those shackles, right? With whatever wiles, like, cuteness, flirtatiousness, that she can weaponize, essentially. And, yeah, I think that she sees these other girls who are around her, right? She even knows they don't like her. They're scared of her. And she's also jealous of them, right? Like, she seems to be jealous of the attention that they would have been getting from Adora. And when the new friend makes a comment about wanting to be a writer, and then Alma immediately is so upset and angry about that. And I don't think that Alma would have stopped, because I don't think that ultimately she needed a justification to kill. Yeah, I think that it is a deep sort of rage from all this trauma, from all these, like, fucked up values she's internalized and who she is, and these sorts of, like, this jealousy or insecurity, it just gave her the perfect outlet for it, not that she needed it. And I don't think she, I don't know, do you think that she would ever stop?
I think maybe eventually. I don't think she'd stop in a in a way that made sense, but I think eventually she'd stop just because she'd get bored of it and do something different. It's like find a new way of doing something and getting control. Whether it was then now she has a family and she has her own child and she's controlling her own child, you know? I think, like, if it were something like that, she would then stop. because she'd have another outlet for it. Yeah, I mean, I feel like that ties in so well, too, with the whole, like, light and the dimness thing, right? And that Amma needed to be the brightest light, and if anyone else's light was shining, she had to, like, kill that down. You know, she even exhibited a bunch of jealousy towards Camille, you know, and, like, and her status in school and her how pretty she was in school and, you know, what people thought about her. Again, just, like, Amma focusing all of her attention and all of her value in your status and popularity, your appearance, your sexuality and your willingness to be sexual, and just getting approval from everyone, because then at home she was a completely different person. She was just exactly who she needed to be when she needed to be it, and at home she was exactly who Adora wanted her to be in order to get approval from Adora. Did you want to talk about the dad?
I really do, yes. What do you think is... what are your ideas on the dad?
The dad reminds me of many fathers I know. Not my own. But he reminds me of many fathers I know. My own stepfather being one of them. Vic's father being one of them. Just a very... whether physically present, a very absent man. And a man that would rather, I don't know if it's making a conscious decision to not speak up about what's happening, or if it's let me ignore it entirely so I don't even notice what's happening, or if it's really just being so dense that they have no idea what's going on around them. And I really doubt that that last one is it. There's no way that you don't know. I think it's making a decision to either let me not even look at it because I know something's happening, or I do see what's happening, but I'm going to keep my mouth shut. And, I mean, just what a small man. He's so pathetic. So pathetic.
It really is. I think that he definitely knew what Adora was doing, because there are a couple of times that he really reacts, right? And he reacts when Adora suggests that they take Amma to the doctor, and he slams his fist down. He says, no, right, we're not taking her to the doctor. And then when he sees her, Adora, walking out of the kitchen with two bottles of poison at the end, and he says, don't overdo it, right? And she's, whatever do you mean, right? And I think the way the way that Amma looks at her dad, there's a lot of resentment there. Like, when she came down and her dad was like, I'll get you some cake, don't interfere, right? And Amma just looks at him with this, I think, fear and also anger and, like, disdain, right? Because this man, he can't ever stand for anything. He can't say anything ever, right? He can't agree with it. He can't disagree with it. He just exists there and is passively complicit. And I would feel so angry towards him. I would almost feel more angry than I would towards the actual aggressor, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you aren't even bearing... you are choosing, probably in your own head, to absolve yourself of any responsibility. You aren't even doing the actual thing, but you are just as guilty, and you don't even want to think of yourself as that.
Yeah.
You can't see yourself as what you are.
Yeah. No, I forgot. It's a huge part, but I did forget it when he does call out Adora, bringing up more drugs than he deems okay. And I feel like he probably knows what happened to her other daughter. There was a time when my stepfather first entered in our lives, and he kind of just ended up there. Like, they were together for a very short while. Like, they married a month after meeting. And then there's just this man that we don't know just living in our house. And he's a very nice man, you know, very, like, funny, you know, just a very happy, go lucky, trying to make light of everything kind of man, but also just a dud.
I love that.
I remember just for years developing this like rage and just really, really hating him because he would be there witnessing all this abuse that, you know, we were receiving from our mom and not saying anything. He wouldn't say a single thing. And obviously I was mad at her, but I was fuming at him because he knew better. You know, I still don't really understand it, and I don't understand being in that position. But the way that I am, like, I can't imagine witnessing something like that. And not at least voicing an objection to what's happening. I understand it's, you can't really control everything, but you can control the way that you respond to things.
This is an uncharitable thought, but I honestly wondered, and the thought just occurred to me now, I wonder if he, because Arma lived longer than Marion did, right? Because Arma was the same age that Camille was when Marion died. And I wonder if he didn't stop it for Marion because it wasn't his daughter.
Well, was he there? Marion. No, because
he was there for Mary. I thought he was there for Marion dying.
No, was he? I don't remember.
Maybe not. Maybe I'm misremembering it. But I wonder if there was any, like, if he had any influence then, like, at all in talking Adora down at all.
I mean, even what we did see, he didn't try very hard, you know?
No, he didn't.
And you know that I feel like that ties back into, in those kinds of households, these moms sort of having control over everything to the point where everyone else will just take a back seat to it. You know, the first time I read the book and the first time I watched the show, I didn't think of the dad even once. He was a nothing to me, not even worth a thought. And then it was after that, you know, I've watched the show a few times now, and now I think about him more, and yeah, even, you know, he would get lost listening to music and just blast music, and that would be his thing, I think, was his way of shutting out what was happening around him. His way of, like, coping, in a sense, but also, you're the adult. It is not time for you to cope. It is time for you to take action and do something. And the way that he carries himself, like he's such a man, you know? And it's like, no, you're such a small, pathetic little being.
Yeah.
All right, rapid fire question time.
Rapid fire question time!
Okay. Number one. Which character do you relate to the most and why?
I knew we were going to have this question coming in, and for some reason
Think about any of these either. We're talking about other stuff. I've completely not thought about that.
I think Camille is too obvious. So aside from Camille, I think I relate a lot to Arma, where she has this combination of desire to conform and then rage against that conformity. And there's all of these conflicting emotions in her, I think. But it all equals out to kind of nothing. You know, she doesn't ever really get to be a person because she's just a mishmash of different external influences, right? And then reactions to those influences, not really her own person. And I think that I have definitely struggled with what is my identity outside of, like, anger towards this person or resentment towards that, and what choices I want to make for myself.
Although you have made a lot of choices for yourself in a lot of ways.
For sure, and I definitely, yeah, that's something that I hold on to now. When I feel like I am struggling, like, I feel like I am, like, disappearing into, like, what I feel like I'm supposed to be, what I don't want to be. Like, I hold on to those.
I think you're much more than Arma. Than Arma is.
Really?
Yeah, I think you're much stronger than Arma is. And I like Alma as a character, and I think, you know, but I think that, I think you're a lot more than she is.
Aww, thanks. Hi.
I hope this isn't too pretentious of me to think that I relate more to Camille, or maybe I'd like to relate more to Camille.
I feel like you and Camille are super similar people.
I thought that you would relate more to Camille.
I think I do relate a lot to Camille. I think there's also a lot of Alma there too. And I feel like you are more like Camille than I am. Like, I feel like you are, like, a much stronger, like, individual force of nature. Like, just naturally, than so... I've ever been. For real, yeah.
It's only because I've been doing it for a little bit longer.
No, I think you're totally brill.
Oh, gosh. Hey, if you were Alma... Lovely question. If you were Alma, how would you prefer to kill and dispose of, or not dispose of, your friends' bodies?
I feel like we could have a whole entire separate episode to, like, serial killer forensics. I think, okay, so from the perspective of Alma, so I'm not caring about them as a person at all, or, like, anything. I don't think I would try to strangle them the way that she did. I don't think I'd be strong enough to. Like, even, I'd be scared that I wouldn't be strong enough to. I honestly think that I would poison them, which I know is much more...
Like a Dora. Like,
that's a statistically... Yeah, it's a statistically very female method of doing it. But it's cleaner, I think. There's no blood... You know, the bodily fluids aren't something, like, out of the ordinary, like vomit or diarrhea. Like, those are something
I love how you say diarrhea. Diarrhea.
They aren't going to show up on forensics, so I don't need to worry about it as much. And it's a very... But it's very, not just clean, but it's cordoned off, I think, maybe. Like, it's self-contained. A self-contained way.
Right.
Yes. And then disposal. If I was a 12-year-old girl, the woods would probably... I don't know how I get her out there. Like, how did she move these full bodies around, even with her friends? I think... Probably in the woods. I definitely don't think I'd have the gall to prop them up in the middle of the town. And if I could get some lines off the bodies, I'd probably do that.
Get some what off the bodies?
Some lye, like the soap.
Oh,
the basic.
Trying to make a skincare out of out of this hobby. Ultimately, I'm only killing my friends because I like really good soap. That's funny. I love how dramatic Alma is about her serial kills. Just, you know, kind of setting them up in these little ways, like they're dolls, and yeah, propping them up.
And the teeth floor as well.
And what? The
teeth floor? The
oh
floor
my god, yeah, yeah, she's so super dramatic. I love it. I don't think that I, which is funny because I actually do, I think we were talking last time, I do love making art out of teeth, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know that, gosh, I feel like we've talked about this before, like me wanting to torture people, or not wanting to, but again, this is an art form. This is a podcast, it's art.
It's an art form.
It's not real. You know, like, sort of daydreaming about doing stuff. And I remember being a kid, like, being Alma's age, and I had one heck of an imagination when it came to torturing, you know, other girls at school that I didn't like. And I would drug them, but only enough to get them tied up in a basement. Not because I'd want the drugs to kill them. I'd want it to be very bloody. Very bloody, but over a long period of time. They would not lose all the blood at once. So it'd be very easy to clean up day to day, you know. And disposing of, You know, once we've bleached out all the blood, it's pretty easy. Just chop them up into bits.
Spread them around the town.
Spread around town. You know.
You could feed them to the
pigs. Grind them up, feed them to the pigs. What was Alma feeding stuff to the pigs? Who knows? Feed them to the pigs. make little meat pies and invite everyone over. You have this big house, you throw all these parties, feed everyone the meat pies. Mm-hmm. Actually, that also sounds very dramatic now. Yes, very Sweeney Todd.
Very Sweeney Todd.
Yes. I like that. Because ultimately, it wouldn't be just about them, because I'm not done answering this, because it really does need to be a James special. It wouldn't be about killing them so much as it would be, like, making them hurt, you know?
Mm-hmm. I feel that way about some men. Not men I know, but, like serial killer men, or, like, you know, men who have done horrible things. That is how I would choose to... do it. Right.
As an art form, though, not really.
It's an art form. A think piece. It's just the imagination.
Painting. Okay, when you die, what memento do you think your friend, or friends, if you happen to be so lucky to have more than one friend, what memento do you think your friends would hang on to?
Is it what memento I think they would hold on to, or what I would tell them to hold on to?
Bitch, this was your question. What did you mean?
I don't know what I meant. That was a different person.
If you came over here, what would you choose to take with you?
I mean, honestly, I feel like you'd probably take, like, I have little glass vials that I use to collect zucchinis and, you know, whiskies and stuff when they fall out. I feel like you'd take one of those vials and then you might, like, put some of my hair into it. So if you went to the funeral, like, or take a couple of my teeth.
I would.
I'd be totally okay with that. You have my full permission to
do that. I would do that. And I would take, like, maybe, like, a piece of jewellery, too, you know, and, like, I can... Not for, like, even if it doesn't have to be expensive, it's not for the value, but, you know, it's kind of, like, very classic having a piece of jewellery from someone, you know?
A deceased someone.
Yeah.
No less.
Right. So, you know, I have it along with the whiskies and... and the hair.
And then... what memento would I have my... So this is going to be a random friend, because I don't know why my brain went to this, but I think it's a bit morbid, so I'm not going to inflict it on you unless you want it. I have this porcelain Japanese box that my father had gotten when he was in Japan, and I've had it for years. And during the most recent move, the bottom of it, not the top, the top's still in pristine condition, but the bottom of it got crushed and it just fell into, like, a whole bunch of pieces. And I gathered up all the pieces and they're in a bag, and I'm waiting until I can, you know, afford a professional restoration. And I think I would make my friend hold on to that. And I would tell them that they have to get it fixed, and that I wanted them to hold on to it forever, to, like, remember me and kind of remember, like, I feel like that box, I don't have many things for my parents, right? And so it's emblematic of a lot of the day-to-day turmoil that I experience, and I'd say, you have to carry that for me.
When it was just a box, like, I'd be willing to take a box, but not with all the expectation. It's a lot. I would leave you my little basket of baby heads. Because
you have a basket of baby heads?
Yes, because why not, you know?
I love that.
It's all the baby bits, though, you know, just little hands and faces.
There's no prejudices against the other bits of the babies.
Yes, and I spent a lot of time, you know, decapitating these babies.
They look very artfully arranged.
It was very, very thoughtful, you know? Very thoughtful without... I wanted it to be thoughtful without looking like I tried too hard, you know? Which ended up taking more time.
More time.
Heads are fascinating.
They are fast. Especially baby heads.
Especially baby heads, yes. They're so, like, large for their bodies.
They are. And quite fleshy.
They're very fleshy. The top is, like... It's like the top of, like, a bottle, you know? Before it's open, yeah. And it's still kind of pushing up and down. Yeah. Like a protective seal of a baby head. Yes. Oh, and their ears are so malleable, like their ears and the noses. You know, like, the cartilage hasn't set in yet, so you can just, like...
So weird.
Anyway, thank you for joining us for this somewhat chaotic British version of Take No Script. Join us in 2 weeks. In the next couple weeks, we'll be talking about...
Pearl. Not the SpongeBob Pearl, but the Tea West Horror 2022 Pearl.
Yes.
I don't know why I said all that.
Starring Mia Goth.
Yes, thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.
Ta-ta.